to another episode of Tales from the Superlaundry. I am here with Jane Willis, and we're here to tell the story, but give a bit of an update, because a lot of individuals that listen to this will be aware of the Do It For Gem campaign, but we're gonna discuss that. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you for having me.
I know we've spoken quite a few times. Yes. You know,
it's nice we're to be in touch. The same room again.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So it's, you know, it's just one of our normal chats, but recorded at the moment.
Yeah.
So we're sitting here in the gorgeous Harbour Hotel, and we are on the eve of the Superior Charities Ball. But we will get to what you're doing at the Superior Charities Ball a bit later. But first of all, we're going to talk about Jem. Now, Jem was your daughter. Can you tell us a little bit about your daughter and what she was like?
The best way to describe Gemma was that she was a beautiful soul. She was nice. You know, when something comes into your life or you do something and you think, that was really nice. Gemma was nice. There was not a bad bone about her. She was friendly. She was happy, always smiling. And just a really beautiful, nice person.
So how did she make her way into the yachting industry?
Gemma followed her brother Charlie's footsteps into the yachting industry. He'd been out there for, I suppose, about 6 years at the time. We had said to her previously, with all her experience and everything that she'd done throughout her working life, you know, you should go out on the yachts, it'd be really good, you know, you've got the experience and the knowledge. And but Gemma was actually scared of boats, believe it or not.
It makes loads of sense.
Yep. As a child, she had this phobia. Nothing happened. She just had this phobia of boats.
To be fair to her, most of the time they are trying to sink, even the big ones.
So, yeah, so she was like, no, I'm not going to work on boats. And it was a holiday that we had together, one of our mother and daughter trips that we had occasionally, where she decided she wanted to look into it more. We was in the Bahamas. There was yachts in the harbour there where we'd sit and have our breakfast, and she would see everyone come out, like all the crew come out in the mornings and go about their duties and say, oh, is that what Charlie does? And, you know, what do the girls do? And got really kind of interested in it. She said, I think I'll look it up when I get back. And she did. We came over to the Isle of Wight for open days at UKSA and Flying Fish. And, she decided to go to UKSA, and that was it. The rest is history. And she actually fell in love with the whole everything about it. She became so passionate about it. She faced all her fears, she was absolutely fine. So all them years of being scared of boats and causing us dramas on pedalos on holiday and everything she done, she loved every minute of it.
Would you say she had any particular highlights from her time on boats that you can remember?
I think she loved everything. She was passionate about it. And I think meeting all the girls that she met, she struggled at school for some reason with girls and had some bullying issues, and actually to the point where we actually took her out of school when she was 14, coming up to 15, because the school wasn't dealing with it. And she never really fitted in with girls from our area. I don't know why. And then when she went onto the yachts, she did. She just really made some really good friends. You know, she met Gemma, who became her best friend, Gemma Holbert, and eventually her chief stew, which was their little plan that they always wanted to work together, and it happened in the end. Unfortunately, not for too long. But I think the connection like she it, made with
it
girls.
It sounds like it was the making of her.
And guys, yeah, it was. It really was, yeah. I mean, she was always she became a very independent person at a young age because she had to. She didn't have the friends that a lot of girls had to go and do things with.
Mm-hmm.
She danced. That's all she wanted to do was dance. So she would travel about London, go to different dance classes. If she wasn't on her own, she was with me. We would do a lot together because she had no choice. That's what she'd done. But, you know, when she went away and worked on the yacht, she just found her forte, I suppose, you know, and just sailed through it and, you know, really got on really well and loved everything about it.
So, obviously, we need to talk about next. When did the problems start? What were the problems for people that haven't
there
heard
was
the story?
No problems. There was no symptoms. There was no illness. There was no sickness. There was nothing. Absolutely nothing. She was one of the most fittest, healthiest people that you'd know. She was really into her fitness. She practiced yoga, you know, as often as she could when she was on board, you know, hopefully every day if she could. But if she would walk, she would hike, she would, she was really fit. And this just came about from her second routine smear test when she was 28. Obviously in the UK, we don't start our smear tests until we're 25. So she did her first one at 25 and that was fine. Apparently, I wonder now, but anyway. So the second one was due 3 years later at the age of 28 and that one came back abnormal. She was at home at the time cause she was on leave. So that coincided nicely. She had a smear test, went back to work. She was based out in the States. And a couple of weeks later, we got a letter through that said that the test had come back abnormal and they wanted to see her again within 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So then she panicked because she was over in the States and said, I can't have it done over here and I want to come home. And I said, you'll be fine. You're in America. It's, you know, meant to be one of the best places for, you know, for medical things. So she did. So she went for another smear test down in Palm Beach, where they was based at the time. And that came back abnormal. And then there was another one. And then she got transferred to another doctor in Miami. And then there was biopsies taken. And in February 2020, she was diagnosed with early stages of cervical cancer.
When the diagnosis came through, how did she take it? How did you all take it?
Well, she was in the States and we was at home. So we was only talking on FaceTime and the telephone. And she didn't seem too concerned. And I actually wasn't too concerned because before they actually said early stages of cervical cancer, when they was doing the tests and they was doing the biopsies, I kept saying to her, you know, it'll probably be abnormal cells. Yeah. I've had abnormal cells.
Yeah, me
too. The majority of my friends have had abnormal cells.
Yeah, yeah.
You have the treatment, you have them blasted, you know, it goes away. So when they actually told her, she'd been backwards and forwards to the appointments up into Miami. And I believe she got a phone call when she was on the yacht and they told her over the phone.
So it's quite difficult with that to kind of, being so remote, to kind of gauge how she's taking it.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean, I just remember because, to be honest with you, the last 3 or 4 years are a bit blurry for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's been such a whirlwind. So I try and think and try and remember things and I can't always remember clearly, but I just remember Gemma Holbert saying that she got the phone call and she was told over the phone and apparently she just carried on making her floral designs on the yacht, making flowers and just had her music on and as far as I know, didn't really kind of say too much.
How did you feel with the diagnosis?
I in disbelief. You know, where's this come from? She hasn't been sick. She hasn't been ill. There's been no symptoms. Where's this come from? So really it was hard to wrap my head around it. I couldn't understand. I was like, you know, so a couple of weeks after, she had to go in to have a comb biopsy done. So Gemma had a rare form of cervical cancer. There's two forms of it. The common one grows from the inside of the cervix out. The rare one grows on the outside of the cervix. Gemma had it grown on the outside of her cervix. And they showed me this on one of her appointments. They put her on FaceTime and showed me with the camera where it was growing. So I saw it all remotely. So I'm at home and she's in Miami. But she seemed okay. She was quite, Gemma was a quite chilled, calm person. And I think she went through so much when she was younger. She just learnt to kind of deal with things, maybe in better ways than other people would. And from what Gemma Holbrook had said, she was just very calm. I was probably more panicking than she was. So then we discussed about me going over to obviously be with her at the beginning of March. And I flew over to Miami, met her doctors, had some chats with the doctors and discussed, you know, everything that was happening.
How did the crew take it? Did you meet the crew when you were over there?
I didn't meet any of the crew, no. I knew of some of them. I knew some of the girls. I knew names and obviously I knew from photos and Instagram and social media who was who. I know one of the girls, her brother had cancer at the time and had a rough few years. And I think she took it quite hard. I think she found it quite hard to talk to Gemma deal with it because she was dealing with her brother. The other girls, as far as I know, was great. You know, they all rallied round and supported her and done everything they could to sort of make her feel.
And the boat okay. The boat insurance was covering everything at this point.
The boat was covering everything, yeah. But at the time, they hadn't told the boss. They hadn't told the boss. And the missus had said to Gemma Holbert a couple of times, is Gigi okay? Now, they called my Gemma Gigi, obviously, because it was confusing with the two Gemmas. Is Gigi okay? She doesn't seem her normal self. And Gemma kept saying, yeah, she's fine. And I think there was a couple of more things where maybe Gemma wasn't quite on top of things as much as she normally was. And it all come out. And then the missus kind of took over the whole situation because her mother-in-law died of cervical cancer a long time ago. So it's quite close to their hearts. So she was quite concerned about me sort of getting over there as quick as possible and getting everything done. And we can't wait for your mum to come over. You need to go in and have this biopsy done. And
that's really nice.
So I was really grateful for her stepping in and doing what she did, for speeding up the process. And I obviously went over there literally just before COVID. And I spent a week over there. The doctor and the oncologist had said to me that they had removed what they had found, obviously, on the outside of her cervix. And they was hoping that was going to be okay and she was going to be fine. So I flew back home with the assurance that she was going to be okay, thinking it's fine, she's going to be fine, she'll carry on. And then a couple of weeks later, after she'd been for a checkup, they said that it wasn't. It was still there. And they wanted to completely remove her cervix.
That's a big surgery.
Yeah, I mean, we had discussed when I was there for that week at the beginning of March, we had discussed what ifs and just in cases, and he'd talked me through cervix removal and, you know, the issue with, you know, having children and, you know, not having children and all that sort of thing. But to actually hear that they wanted to remove her cervix, I think that's when it kind of like hit a little bit more. Yeah, like, this is really
serious.
This is really serious.
So So obviously she's over in America. The boat's been really supportive. When did she come back to the UK?
So she ended up coming back at the end of April. So she went in to have her cervix removed. That turned into a hysterectomy because they took 23 lymph nodes out of her pelvic area and the cancer was in 9 of them. So they obviously called us to get permission to do the surgery, and went ahead and, you know, we couldn't give them an answer. We just didn't know what to say. We just sat there crying because we just didn't know what to say to them. And in the end, we said to him, you know, you're the professional. You need to do what's best for Gemma. And he said, I'm going to do the hysterectomy. Because otherwise, he said, she would have had to have come out of the surgery. He would have had to explain it to her. Yep. She would have had to have done. So he just done it.
How do you feel making that decision?
Awful. Because she was going in under the understanding that, you know, we talked about children and how she could have a surrogate child and this, that and the other. And now they're talking about, well, you know, they're taking everything away.
Yeah.
So there would be nothing for a child, you know. So I was making that decision and she didn't know about it because she went in thinking she was just having her cervix taken out. And I felt awful. But we needed to do the best thing for her. And at the time, that's what we thought was the best thing.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until she came back to London, and then in the UK, they do everything opposite. They do treatments first in the UK and then they do surgeries, whereas in the US they do surgeries first and then they do treatments. So then in one appointment, her oncologist in London was quite harsh with me, and she said to me, you know, she didn't need to have these surgeries, she didn't need to have the hysterectomy, which made me feel even worse, because at the time I'm thinking, okay, so this is awful, but if he's taken everything out,
surely it's gone.
It's gone, and nothing else can grow. But it had already, it was already in her lymph nodes.
So obviously she started treatment. When did you find out that it was terminal? And obviously this went on for quite some time. Can you just give me a couple of standout moments from that period of time in her treatment?
So the word terminal was never mentioned. They said to us in end of May, just before she started chemo in London, that it had turned, because it was spreading through her lymph nodes, it had turned it into stage four. It had gone from early stages of cervical cancer in February, and now we're like end of May, beginning of June. They're telling us it's stage four, incurable, but treatable cancer. How does that happen? Anyway, so
what are this, you know, obviously it's a quite a long period. There are a couple of moments during that time, that tough time, that really stand out for you, that kind of would sum up that whole process that you went through.
So everything, the fact that we was in a COVID pandemic, and you know, Gemma had to go to the majority of appointments on her own. I wasn't allowed in the hospital with her. I did figure out how to get in the end, but you know, if I was caught, I got chucked out. But it was horrendous. You know, you've got all the whole thing of what's going on, but also we've got this COVID pandemic on top of it. So you're so frightened of her getting COVID, us getting COVID. What happens if, you know, she's sick, her immune system's low, she's having treatment. What happens if she gets COVID, you know? So that was horrendous. The whole, everything, walking into a chemo world for the first time. I mean, they don't explain to you, they don't tell you that you walk out of the lift and you're in the ward and you can see everyone sitting there having their treatments. You know, they don't explain that to you. So when you walk out of the lift for the first time and you're scared anyway, I mean, she was like a rabbit caught in headlights. You know, she just could not stop crying. And I was trying not to cry because I'm holding it together for her, trying to make her feel better. And, you know, just looking at everyone just hooked up to their IVs, having their treatment was just horrible. But,
what was she like during that time?
She was scared. But she was also very determined and very positive that she was going to beat this and she was going to be fine. You know, a few months down the line into her chemo, if you didn't know Gemma, you wouldn't have even known there was anything wrong with her. You know, she was actually glowing. When she came out of treatment, she would be in treatment for 8 hours. She was on three different chemotherapies. They told us they was going to throw the kitchen sink at her because she's young and she's healthy and she can take it. So we'd pick her up in the evening and she'd come out glowing. Her skin looked amazing and she just she had the cold cap, so she didn't lose a lot of her hair at first. She had a lot of hair like me, so if you didn't know her, she'd have her hair in a ponytail and you wouldn't even think there was anything wrong with her.
What was the support like from the yachting industry?
Really good. I mean, you know, she's her work colleagues, you know, colleagues that she'd worked with before on other yachts, people that she'd just sort of got to know, just people that she didn't even know that had got to know her through Instagram, through Floating Florista. I mean, the messages that she was getting daily all the time from, you know, girls and guys, just constant messages. And sometimes she didn't want to read them and she'd give me the phone and I'd read through them and it would just overwhelm me, like the messages that she got. I mean, the support was amazing.
And you tell us a little bit about the fund that was raised.
So fast forward a couple of months and we were talking about different treatments and her oncologist told us that there was two options. Apart from the chemo, there was two other options. There was clinical trials or there was immunotherapy. Clinical trials, you have to be at a certain fitness level. And at the time we was talking to our oncologist, she wasn't fit enough to be put forward for a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. So we discussed immunotherapy, but immunotherapy isn't available on the NHS in the UK. It's only available privately. And her actual oncologist sat in her office and said to us, told us all about the immunotherapy, but then said, I'm very sorry, we can't give it to you on the NHS. But you can come to my Harley Street clinic and I can treat you there. So how much is that? £10,000 a treatment. Wow. So how many treatments will she need? Well, she'll need a minimum of 10 treatments and a maximum of 30.
30 treatments?
So I said, well, I haven't got £10,000 sitting there, let alone £100,000. And then if she needs more, I haven't got £300,000 sitting there. So obviously, you know, this, you know, talking to Gemma and other people, you know, they started, there was a local GoFundMe started from an old work colleague of her from a bar that she used to work in. And then the yachting GoFundMe page started.
You had some fantastic donations from the yachting industry.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, you know, like I said, them few years are kind of like, it's like a dream. It's like surreal. Like I haven't processed any of it because it all happened so quick. And even now, I mean, I'm in therapy and I still can't understand or process anything because it just came from nowhere and it happened too quick. You know, it's like I've been in a bad dream. And I'm awake and she's okay. She's on a yacht somewhere and she's fine. And that's how I get through a lot of my days because obviously we was used to her not being at home for so many months at a time. So I get through my days thinking she's at work, you know, and then obviously some days I realise she's not at work and I just think, come on, Gem, you know, it's time to come home now. I'm not going to say what I'm thinking, but, you know, you need to come home. I need to see you. So that really kicked off at the ACRA Awards in Barcelona, where she was nominated for the Senior Crew Award and obviously couldn't go. So Gemma Holbert, sorry, I keep saying Gemma Holbert because obviously it's confusing with the two Gemmas.
Gemma Holbert, the yacht
shoe. Went over for Gemma and, you know, accepted her award and spoke for her. And they played the video of Gemma that we called in the hospital, which is a really bittersweet memory because I remember how many takes we took to do this video because every time we started the video, something happened on the ward. So we ended up laughing more than anything trying to get this video finished. So that's a really kind of bittersweet memory of when we done that. But that was just amazing. I mean, I saw the money coming in, but I wasn't really, because I had so much going on, I was like, oh my God, there's another lot coming in. And I couldn't believe what people was donating.
It's quite amazing.
It was, and how quick it happened. But unfortunately, it didn't come in time for her to have the treatment. She became very sick very quickly. The second time round, obviously, she had that 3 months where they told us it had gone to sleep. And then 3 months later, it appeared in our liver again, and then escalated from there. And then it was just really quick, and we couldn't keep up with the chemo couldn't keep up with how quick it was spreading. And she lost all her positivity, all her determination. It got to the point where she told me she didn't want to know anything that was happening anymore. She just wanted the doctors to talk to me. She didn't want to know. Occasionally, she would ask me if she was going to die. And I told her, no, you're not going to die, Gemma. You're going to be fine. We're going to get through this and you're going to be fine. And now I feel that she's angry with me because I told her she was going to be fine and she wasn't.
I agree with you.
And that's something that I'm trying to deal with, and I'm trying to get past, because I know people say to me, she's not angry with you, but I just feel, you know, she told me she didn't want to know anything, and every conversation I had from there, you know, I didn't tell her. They didn't say to me, they never gave us a timeline. They never mentioned the word terminal. They never spoke about end of life.
They just never stated the obvious.
They just kept telling me she's very sick. We knew she was very sick. You know, we couldn't get on top of the sickness. We couldn't get on top of all the side effects. We couldn't get on top of anything. The medications wasn't working. It was just relentless. And we were just constantly in and out of hospital, backwards and forwards, because she'd be okay for a day and then she wouldn't be for a week and then she would be, you know, and it was up and down. It was a roller coaster.
What happened the day she died?
So 5 days before she died, we was told that it had spread to her brain. It had already gone to her back, and we found out 6 or 8 weeks before that it was in her back. And then on the 15th of October, we was told it had gone to her brain. And they told us that it was spreading quicker than the chemo was working, and they're going to stop the chemo. And there was nothing else they could do for her. The only other option, possible option, was the immunotherapy. So her dad said, look, we've got the money coming in now for the immunotherapy. Can we start the treatment? But at that moment in time, she was too sick, because you still have to have a little bit of, like, you still have to be at a certain fitness level to take the treatments. So the doctor said to us that they was talking about putting her into a hospice for respite and rehabilitation, and they would monitor her for the next few weeks and see how she goes, and then obviously have more discussions about possibly having the immunotherapy, which then her oncologist would then take over, because it would be at her clinic in Harley Street. That was Friday the 15th of October. Next couple of days, she seemed okay. She was very sick, but she seemed okay in herself, like she was compos mentis, as they say. She was, you know, if I popped home to have a shower or get Klinko, she'd use her phone, and she knew what she was doing. And a couple of her friends said to me that she'd called them. But one of her best friends, who is over here, did actually say to me that she felt the day that she called her, she was calling her to say goodbye. She said she sounded okay. She sounded okay in herself. She said that I'd gone home to get clean clothes or whatever, and Gemma had called her. But she said after it happened, she said, I felt like she was calling me to say, 'cause she knew she wasn't going to see me again. On the Monday and Tuesday, she went downhill rapidly. But they was putting the plans in place to move her to the hospice on the Thursday, the 21st. So that's just what we was doing. We was sitting in the room with her. You know, her dad would come in and out. Her brother Charlie was in and out. I was there all the time. And then on Wednesday the 20th, that night, I had a really, really bad night with her. And I called her lovely nursing, because I couldn't do anything right. She was asking me to help her get comfortable and do this, that and the other. And everything I was doing was wrong. She kept telling me off because I was doing it wrong. So I called Louisa in and I said to her, can you help me? I said, because whatever I'm doing is wrong. So she'd done exactly what I was doing. But then Gemma was getting her hand and saying, thank you very much. You're so lovely. Thank you very much for telling me off. But it was obviously part of what was going on. I mean, now I look back, I think, well, obviously that was, there was things happening.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise at the time. And on Thursday, she was due to be moved to the hospice. And Louisa had said that she's going to get the doctors to come in and see her because she wasn't sure whether she wanted her to be moved or not. They came in and decided not to move her that day. They said, we'll postpone it for a couple of days and see how she is. So I called her dad up and said, like, when you're coming, he's a black cab driver, he's normally in London by like 6 o'clock. So I said, so when you get into London, can you come in? Because I've had a horrendous night. I'm so tired. I just need like 10 minutes just come and sit with her. And then he called Charlie, and Charlie was coming up anyway. So we was all in the room and just sitting and talking to her. We had the radio on. And Gemma Holbert had called and said that she was coming into London to give Gemma her ACRA award, because she was going back to Canada and wanted to give it to her before she left. Said that she'd be in London by about 3 o'clock. So I put the phone to Gemma's ear and she could hear her talking. And she was smiling and she seemed happy that she was coming. And we just sat there just peacefully all day. She was sleeping on and off. You know, Martin and Charlie was popping in and out for coffees, and I just stayed in the room with her. Talking to friends, I was passing messages on to her that people were sending through, and she was just sleeping really peacefully. And I just thought, that's good. She's, you know, while she's asleep, she's kind of resting and recuperating, and you know. And at 3 o'clock on the 21st of October, she just went into, I don't know whether you'd call it a cardiac arrest, I don't know, something, it was to do with her breathing. And they had said to me about three or four weeks before, they'd pulled me out of the ward one day and said to me that they'd discussed resuscitating if anything happened. And they'd made the decision that because she's so frail that they wouldn't do that. Well, this is the first I'd heard of it. So I just went a little bit loopy about it and told them all where to go and said, why are you saying this to me? And kind of went away and didn't really, it was in the back of my head, but I didn't really think too much about it because I'd watched my mum pass away 6 months before. I'd talked about end of life and I'd been in the home with her and I'd sat with her and the nurses had talked me through, you know, the process and what happens. And I hadn't had none of that with Gemma. So I was thinking, well,
do you think that's acceptable? She's not being funny or anything, but when you've got an ill, elderly mother, it's easier to accept.
Yeah, my mum was 92.
You wouldn't want to accept this.
No, it's like, you know, so I kind of got that because they talked to us about it. But we didn't have this conversation about Gemma with any of the doctors. The word terminal was never mentioned. The only time was when they said it was stage 4 incurable but treatable cancer back in May. There was no conversation with the word terminal in it. There was no conversation about end of life. So when it did happen, I was very angry because I felt they hadn't done their job properly and they hadn't talked us through things and, you know.
Yeah.
So I was very angry, but then I thought, it happened so quick. Did they even know? Did they actually even know what was happening and it was happening so quickly? Did they? I don't know, and I will never know. And I don't know, I feel they could have talked to us a lot more about things. But like I said, on the other hand, maybe they didn't realise. And it just did happen so quick. But she literally just was sleeping. So it was peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Well,
she wasn't.
As well as you can hope.
She wasn't in pain. She was comfortable. and literally, yeah, just sleeping. And then 10 minutes later, Gemma arrived at the hospital and walked into the whole
looking thing, back so. On that situation, obviously, because it's been a few years now, is there any advice that you can give anybody who's losing a relative or a loved one in that way? What would you say to somebody who's going through the same thing that they need to remember or do? Or
I think just make as many memories as you can, whether they're in the hospital or out of the hospital. If they're out of the hospital, if they're okay to do things, or, you know, just do things at home, just make memories and talk. And, you know, if they're in the hospital, then, you know, talk about things in the hospital, go over to just anything, just talk to them. Because I sat there for days while she was sleeping, and I'd be reading a book, or I'd be listening to the radio or a podcast, or I'd be catching up with messages, because obviously I was inundated all day long with messages from, you know, every platform. So I'd be catching up on messages, and I just let her, you know, sleep. But now I just wish I'd got in the bed with her more and
woke her up.
Talked to me. And, you know, yeah, we did, you know, we did talk, but obviously I wasn't going to wake her up to talk. But now I think, well, I would have woke her up, and I would have made her carry on talking, and
squeeze every last
just
moment.
Every moment. Yeah. And we spent a lot of time apart because of COVID, because we wasn't allowed in the hospital. So there was a lot of times when she was actually admitted in hospital, and they was telling us that we could only have two visits a week. Mm. And it was only like one person. So her dad was saying to me, well, you go yeah. and see her. So I dealt with everything from the time she arrived back in the UK. I dealt with every appointment, every telephone call, every discussion we had, all the treatments that I could get into. I dealt with everything. I carried everything, and I had to relay it all back to her dad, you know, every day. I think Charlie was he away at the time? I think he might have still been on board at the time, but he did come home eventually. But it was just, yeah, just all on my shoulders. And I just feel that if they knew what was really going on, but I just feel like I wish I could have talked to her more and just spent more time with her. You know, I feel like all them weeks that she was in hospital when I wasn't allowed in there.
So now we're on the other side, without Gem. What? Please tell me about the Do It For Gem campaign.
So the Do It For Gem campaign. So Do It For Gem came about in the first place from the fundraising. They started using the hashtag come about Do It For Gem, and it just stuck. So I decided I wanted to start a foundation. We had the money, obviously, that was raised for Gemma, and due to, obviously, everyone's got different opinions, but, you know, due to my reasonings and things that people had said to me, they wanted me to do, the money was raised for Gemma, they wanted me to do something for Gemma, something Gemma would have loved to do or loved, you know. So Gemma loved beach huts. You know, growing up, we'd go to the seaside, you'd see the beach, lovely beach huts, mm-hmm. and they're normally passed down in families because they're so expensive, and, you know, you very rarely sort of just say, oh, I'm going to buy a beach hut. Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite happen like that. And the last few days of summer in 2021, before she went back into hospital and stayed in there, we went out on a few day trips to the seaside and to the beach huts, and she just wanted to get out and about. It was in between a chemo at the time. And we had some beach hut days, and she'd talk about how nice they are and how lovely it'd be to have one and how she'd decorate it and, you know, and everything happened. And I just thought, like, what could I do? What would she love? So I thought, let's get a beach hut. Let's decorate it all to Gemma's taste, how she would talk, and obviously I knew her taste with things anyway, and gift it out to cancer patients in between their treatments for respite days, because she loved to just have a packed lunch and a book, or she liked a bit of colouring or drawing or whatever, and she'd be in her element, just sitting there watching the world go by, having a snooze, having a bit of packed lunch, and she loved it. And Walton on the Naze was the last place we spent the day at with her. And we had a really nice day. She slept quite a lot, but she was actually doing really well that day, because when we go back, we always say where the beach hut is, it's there's four rows. So you've got the front row on the promenade and we're on the top row. And to get to our hut, you walk along a little path and you go up a slope to where you can park the cars. And this slope is quite a slope. I actually struggle sometimes walking up and down it. And every time I go down there, we say, do you remember when she walked up this slope that day and she was ahead of me and the car wasn't even parked in the little road at the top? It was parked a lot further on, and she'd done a lot of walking that day. When we went down, when we first went arrived, we parked too far from where the beach, we didn't know where this beach hut was. We kind of looked on the map and thought, okay, we'll park there. And it was actually quite a long walk, but we had a lot of bits and pieces with us. So we had a wheelchair and everything was on her wheelchair, and she wanted to walk.
Mm-hmm.
And she walked all the way back to the car after. And we still, every time we go, we always say to each other, do you remember that day she walked up this slope? And do you remember that day she walked all that? And that was only 4 weeks before. It was only 4 weeks before. And she, you know, she had a lovely day. She just sat on her, we took her sun lounger and she sat on that and she read and she watched the world go by and she had a picnic. And Martin decided to do a puppet. There was puppets in there for the kids. Me and Gemma was sitting out by the seawall. As the sun goes round, you kind of move further away. And we was trying to get the last bit of the sun by the seawall. And we heard all this Punch and Judy talking coming out of the beach. And it was her dad up at the window with all these puppets. So I never remember, she cracked up laughing. It was, yeah, it was really, it was just a really nice day.
So, a really nice talking, day. So talking about the foundation, what is the goal with the foundation? What are you wanting to achieve out of this horrible situation? What is your goal?
We bought the beach hut, we refurbished the beach hut. We started last summer was the first summer that people started going down there. So we had a few cancer patients go down there. We had a few people hire it for the day, which is obviously available, and then the hire goes back into obviously the upkeep and the maintenance and the leases and the licenses and everything we have to sort of pay towards it. So obviously we want to carry on with that. I want to expand on how we have people going down there. It's working now on like a nomination system. So you'd contact us through the website and we'd send you the form to nominate someone to go down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to work with a couple of other cancer charities. That there's one in particular local to me who deals with like young children and young adults.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to work with them a lot more so that they can recommend people to go, and it's a little bit more closer to just being a big, wide open, anyone can go type thing.
You're officially registered as a charity now, yeah. So I suppose that makes life.
Yeah, that took 18 months. It took such a long time. They blamed it all on, like everyone does, blames everything on COVID. There's a backlog. Anyway, it came through eventually last October. And unfortunately, at the end of last year, I was quite poorly, so I didn't do anything up until Christmas. So now I'm kind of, getting out there and putting it out there. And on top of that, the Do It For Gem campaign came along. Thanks to you and Pearls of Wisdom.
Well, we obviously you came on as a fabulous guest speaker at the event, but from my perspective, I think it's you know, I've said it countless times, it's very, very important that we take away, you know, any barriers for a woman keeping up to date with her smear and keeping up to date with looking after herself. And I think the industry needs to make sure that women have seamless care. You know, they can go wherever they want, whatever port, at whatever time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like I've said many times, it's not a nice to have. It's an essential part of life as a woman to maintain our, you know, our health.
Well, it is. And I've had so many, I've had so many conversations over the, you can imagine, over the years where, you know, I have women that say to me, oh, I don't like having them done, or no, I've never had one. And you can imagine how frustrated I get with them. And I'm like, what do you mean you haven't, you need to have it done? And
they're not nice.
No, they're not nice. None of us. They're not that scary either. The few minutes that it takes. Yeah. I mean, yes, you know, it can be embarrassing at first, and yes, it can be a bit uncomfortable, but it's no worse than a period pain.
Mm.
You know, it's.
And also, when you get pregnant, you have like loads of people.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not really a big thing anymore. Afterwards.
Yeah, no. So the Do It For Gem campaign is all about spreading the awareness of cervical cancer and the fact that there isn't always symptoms of cervical cancer, because there is a lot of charities, a lot of organisations, a lot of platforms out there that all spread the awareness about cervical cancer and its symptoms, but they never seem to talk about there's not always symptoms.
No, that's why it's important.
Yes,
so you keep up to date with going to your regular
checkups. I want
women
to, you know, we're not invincible. You know, Gemma was the most fittest, healthiest, because I had a few people say to me, but she's so young and she's so fit and she's so healthy. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how young and fit you are. It doesn't matter what colour you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter about anything. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people, you know, and men need to understand as well. I mean, I know obviously we're focusing on the yachting industry, but it's all industries. But in the yachting industry, you know, the majority of captains are men, you know, and they need to understand that if a stewie is having problems, if she is having some symptoms of some sort, and, you know, she's got women's problems, then they need to, if she needs to go and have an appointment or she needs to have a test done, they need to let her off. Not, you know, not, don't say to her, oh, in your own time, you know, not in the boat's time.
No, 100%.
You know, it's not fair. It needs to be. So I want to kind of, yeah, talk about it more in the industry and yeah. Not, I mean, I want to go into, my plan is to, through 2024, is to start going into senior schools, colleges, universities, nice. Workplaces, health and wellness events, anywhere where there's women, and talk about, because I've had a couple of girls, 14, 15, in front of me with their mums that have talked to me about Gemma, and they don't even know what smear test is.
Well,
you know, by the time you're 15, you should know what a smear test is.
You should know. To obviously start you off, you're obviously speaking at the Super Yacht Charities Ball tomorrow.
I am. Yes.
So finally, thank you for telling your story to me.
Thank you for having me.
I think, you know, obviously I'm very passionate about this as a project, and I really do think we can just solve it, and then we won't need to be so aggressive about getting it out there.
I think
we can really, really help. But if anybody who's listening to this wants to do anything, where do they get in touch with you?
So they go to floatingflorista.co.uk. Everything is on there about the foundation, about Gemma's stories on there, about the beach hut, the purpose of the foundation, what I'm doing, what I'm planning to do, everything is on there. Or, you know, there's Instagram, the Floating Florista Instagram account. There's a page on Facebook that don't really use Facebook that much anymore. But, Instagram or the website.
So please, if you're listening to this, please check out the Floating Florista. We've also got a directory that is on, will be connected to the Floating Florista website. It's through Pearls of Wisdom. Gemma the Hobbit, the Yacht Stewards, also has the same directory. And we have a fantastic lady called Caroline Blatter from Super Yacht Services Guide, which you would have probably known if you're provisioning in the industry. She's got a category, so just put in cervical and it will give you all of the locations where you can get your smear done on the planet. And
yeah, because the girls, you know, it doesn't matter where they are in the world, you know, they need to be able to feel safe and feel comfortable to go and have this smear test. Don't wait until you go, you know, you might not get off board for another 6 months. If you need to have your test done, have it done and feel comfortable having it done wherever you are in the world.
Yeah. So, yeah, the directory, trusted locations. Thank you so much again, Jane, for telling your story.
That's okay.
If you're listening to this podcast, thank you very much for joining us. If you want more information or you need more support, please go to the Pearls of Wisdom app We've got all of the information in there, the community's in there, and yeah, we'll see you next time.